I'm Bob Earl. I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic.
Oh, water. Yeah, I love water, please.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Can't breathe. Might as well drink water.
Can't hear? Where can't you hear? Huh? Oh. Is that better? You're more than welcome. My pleasure. Hate to think both of us come here and get nothing out of it. I gotta tell you, that isolated non-smoking room is terrific. I want to share with you something that a few months back I had an opportunity to do, and I did, and I'm glad I did it, and you're not going to be glad I did it when I get done talking about it. through an acquaintance of mine, he put me in touch with four people who were on a little trip, taking a little tour around, looking into different things going on in the world for different reasons, and two of these guys were psychiatrists, highly qualified, educated enough to practice a couple of, I guess, specific different fields of psychiatry. I don't fully understand all that, but in it, brains. The boys were smart. And those two guys were fascinating because they had been raised in spiritual households. They were raised vegetarian. They had never drank any alcohol, never drank any diet colas, had never eaten sugar, had never eaten meat, had never smoked a cigarette, had never done any of those things, and they were both in their 40s. All right? So this wasn't something they started with mom and dad last week. You know, they weren't 3 years old. And the thing about being around them that was fascinating is the peace. They were very peaceful people. They were like, you just would look into one of their eyes and you just go, you know, it's like, somehow you knew it was all okay. It just didn't matter what was going on. It was all okay. So I brought these four to, they were curious about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I brought them. I let them come here and watch us in our habitat. Okay? I mean, this is our habitat, guys. This is where we live. This is where we show, you know, a lot of the insanity. And after a couple of these, we got together and we talked about their perception, coming from where they're coming from, of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the fascinating thing is the four of them said exactly the same thing. They said it in different words, they used different terminology, but they said the very same thing, and they made the same observation. In essence, they said they were stunned. They were absolutely stunned, okay? Because what they had viewed here was people that were inflicted with a terminal illness. They all four were convinced that alcoholism is a terminal illness, that it will kill you. They didn't even question that for a minute. Just the spiritual guys were operating as much off of intuition as they were information, and they just felt the disease. They just knew it was terminal. And they said, and by a grace, by a miracle, the psychiatrist had other terminology. They applied it more to one of the finest self-help programs, the application of that, blah, blah. But anyway, they were saying the same thing the other guys were saying. By the way of a miracle, these people have had removed from them a terminal illness. Removed by grace. They have been given life again, and they sit in those rooms and continue to fucking kill themselves. They said they smoke cigarettes by the carton, they drink coffee by the barrel, and they eat sugar by the pound. Their sleep habits are horrible, and they seem to rather, they prefer running on a high level of anxiety to breathing. Nobody breathes. You sit in a meeting and nobody breathes. You know, you can't hear the people next to you breathing. Because they're not. They're just a little short breath. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic. This is my family. I'm, you know, I'm an old street dope fiend. This is my people they're talking about. And I bristled. You know, the hair got straight up and the neck got big. And I was going to say something to them, but I couldn't think of anything to say. I couldn't defend it. There was no defense available. They were right. Their observation was correct. And I had nothing to say. I couldn't say, well, but you must understand. Because I know what they would have said, and I didn't even want to be there for that, you know. And I, you know, and it's the thing that you start thinking about it, and I realize that why do we do that? Because it's true. I mean, we're given another chance at life. A gift is given to us. They say, here is life. God has said, come sit, my children, among your brothers and your sisters, and you have another shot at life, and we do everything we can to fuck it up. Everything in our power to not have a good time with it. Anything but be happy. God forbid we should laugh through a whole 24 hours and have a good time. It's like, have you ever noticed, if you're walking just through your own house feeling good, your mind will ask you why, you know. Why are you feeling so good today? You obviously aren't in touch with the reality of your life. Or you wouldn't feel so good. And then immediately we go into, oh, God, right, yeah, it really is bleak, you know. And the anxiety sets up, and then we look for some other kind of something to stuff the feelings, whether it's the cigarettes, the coffee, the sugar, the food, or however we choose to do it. I'm convinced today, after being sober for over 21 years, that the same group of guys that wrote our book were very advanced thinkers for their time. You got to remember, Bill was in therapy in 1937, right? I mean, he knew. They were smart enough to send an original manuscript of the book to psychiatrists to get their input. I mean, they knew there were other things and other avenues and that they needed, and religion, and they incorporated ministers. And I'm convinced that you took that same group of guys that founded AA back then and brought them forward to now, to 1984, and they were to find AA new, brand new, for the first time today, incorporated in the program would be nutrition, would be therapy, would be diet, would be no smoking, would be exercise, absolute exercise program, guaranteed. Because I know, I just went through a thing where about, I was starting to get a little crazy here for a couple of days. And the reason was I'd been running for a year, and I'd gone to Honolulu and did a marathon, and my knee went out in the marathon. So I hadn't run since December. And I was walking along like I was okay. But this anxiety was just coming up. And the other last couple of days, I started to get, it was hard to be around me, you know? I wasn't the peaceful, quiet, jovial self I usually am. I was a little intense. Clinging to the steering wheel. You know how you get? I mean, nobody does anything right, wherever you are. I mean, somebody's always in front of you. Somebody's always in the way. The market's got too many people. There's a broad in front of you with 20 items in the 8-item or less line. There's people are boxing you in intentionally on the freeway, and you know it, and the paranoia rages, you know. Jesus. Something's wrong here, you know. I mean, not good program, Robert. You're, you know. So I went and bought an extra cycle quick because we're waiting to see whether I have to have surgery on the knee or not. I got to tell you, 2 days on a bicycle, I feel so much better. And yet, as I was riding this bicycle, as I was pedaling this bicycle, sitting still in my living room, I could feel the tears, my sadness, and the anger and the frustration just burning out. Just burning out with the exercise. You may say, what has all this got to do with staying sober? It depends on what kind of sobriety you want, I guess. It's kind of like whatever you want is available here. See, I think that based on my experience in sobriety, you know, screw drinking and using it. I don't even, you know, somebody will come next week and tell their story and about 20 minutes out of the Joe Miller joke book. Sobriety is like sobriety is a blessing. Now, why don't we take advantage? Why didn't I take advantage of this blessing? Well, the reason I didn't take advantage of this blessing when it was first given to me is that I am burdened by my mind. The sign I hate worst of all in AA is that one. It's just think, think, think. That's not one of the original signs, guys. It's not in the book. The printer gave that and one other sign to them when they picked up the first batch. He knew enough to get it out of his shop. But we hang it. Think, oh yeah, God, I love to think. Let's go home and think. You know,
Fuck action. We'll find a solution to this in a chair, you know. By all means, think everything through. And if you reach 5 years, you'll be lucky. But I came in with a kind of mind that likes to think, and it has observations and opinions about everything. It doesn't have to know anything about the subject, but it has an opinion immediate, you know, it's that quick. So at my very first AA meeting, I came out of a doorway on Skid Row. I was living outdoors, sleeping on rooftops, and I was brought to AA and put in an AA meeting. And I sat in that AA meeting totally defeated, 26 years of age, 135 pounds, almost dead, and the brains were gone, long gone, completely fried by every kind of chemical imaginable, to severe overdoses, to, you know, pronounced dead more than once. So this is what I bring to AA. I sit in my first AA meeting, they bring a cup of coffee, they put it in front of me so I could sip it like a dog because I couldn't pick it up, you know. And this marvelous being looks around this AA meeting. The mind makes an observation. Says, boy, we have sunk to the fucking bottom of the pit this time. This is the end of the road. Now, I had been agreeing with this thing for 26 years. There's absolutely no reason for me to change at my first AA meeting. So I looked around the room and I said, yeah, you're right. This is it. This is the end of the road. Now, there's an interesting thing that happened to me. The minute I did that, I was setting up how I was going to work the program and what I was going to do about my life. Because in essence, what I'm saying, if this is the end of the road, if AA is a stopgap, in other words, if all AA, well, what I was saying to myself is AA is what you do between drinking and using and dying. So you can't get loaded and you can't die, you go to meetings. You know, that's it. That's what AA is all about. Well, if this is the end of the road, how much effort are you going to put into this program? How much energy are you going to put into it? How many times are you going to look in different directions to see what you can find to make you feel better? How much effort are you going to put out in your own behalf? That's another thing. It's like, you know, with the smoking thing, it's like, I got a bomb dropped on me, and it still took me months to do anything about it. Months to do anything about it. And I was angry because I couldn't figure out why. I thought, why can't I do something for myself? You know, I drive 150 goddamn miles to pick somebody up to take them to put them in a hospital or something, and I can't. I'll sit up all night with somebody in pain. Why can't I put myself through any discomfort for me? I'll do it for you. Why won't I do it for me? Don't I care enough about myself? And I was researching a thing, and I was down at suicide prevention. I was sitting in this room with all the people then in those days that were running suicide prevention in L.A. We're in this little boardroom, and I whipped out my Marlboros and pulled one out and lit it and then looked, and there was no ashtray in the room. Now, you know you're in trouble when you're a smoker, right? There's no, not an ashtray. There's five people in the room and no ashtray. Now you know you're a minority. So somebody got up, went out, left the door open, rattled through some cabinets, made a big, you know, ordeal out of getting this ashtray, brought it back and put it in front of me so that we could go on with his meeting. And this one guy says to me, he said, we have an opinion here at suicide prevention, an official opinion on cigarette smoking, if you're interested in it. And before my intuition spoke, before my mind had a chance to shut it up, I said, yeah, sure, what is it? And the guy said, well, with all the scientific information that's in, that is factual and not theory, with all the information that is in, we now consider smoking, the fact that you know it will kill you, is covert suicide. It is a little tiny gun with a little tiny bullet. Needless to say, I ground out my Marlboro, didn't smoke it for the rest of the discussion, which was some 4 hours long, and left there thinking, every time I lit a cigarette, that's all I could think about, what they had said to me. But I couldn't stop. I couldn't bring myself, it took me months, like about 8 months, to bring myself to a place where I was willing to give it up, where I was willing to go through any kind of discomfort to get that habit out of my life. Why? I'm convinced, my opinion, that the number one problem of the drug addict and the alcoholic, drinking and using certainly, but also in sobriety, is self-esteem. That we don't care enough about ourselves to take care of ourselves. We do the survival stuff. You know, it's like, I'm a survivor. Most of us are survivors.
I know how to get a bed, get a pack of cigarettes, get a meal, get a cup of coffee, you know, get gas for the car, work at any kind of job. I can survive. I'll survive. I can get out there and survive. But I don't know anything about living. I don't know anything about accepting the abundance. I don't know anything about having success in my life. And when I have it, I wiped it out. I mean, after... Well, let me see. Let me try and put together a talk here now. I don't know why. I'm having a good time. just... It's fun up here. You should be up here. I have got for those of you who know me really well, I've spent years talking about the committee and all the voices, you know, the many, 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 many voices talking all at once in the mind. I have now got it down to four. Now, I'm sure if I stopped the average guy on the street and told him I only had to live with four voices every day, he might not find that representative of hope. But we know better, don't we? We know four is a very small amount compared to the usual madness. You know, you leave your house in the morning alone in your car and you feel like you have a station wagon full of kids. You know, all of whom are very unruly and don't want to go where they have to go. You know, no, fucker, we're not going to do that today. We'll go here, you know. Well, you're not going to get there anyway. You know, no, turn here. No, go there. It's, you know. He's just trying to get down the street, you know. So to be to four, maybe we'll go this way. Yeah, to be to four personalities for me is wonderful. Wonderful, because now I know what's going on. See, when I was 17 years sober, I ran into a snag. The snag was I felt like a hamster. You know? I mean, I've been here for 17 years, clean and sober, recognized authority. And hey, you know, junior guru, man. 17 years, and I'm... in the same place I'd been for years. You know, here I was, and I felt like this little animal in a little wheel, just going, you know. And it's like nothing had changed. And it's like, I heard a great line, and I was in Laguna a couple, 3 weeks ago with friends, and we were discussing, I don't remember, somebody probably. And I remember saying something about, how could she have done that with 20 years of sobriety? And this guy said, no, you misunderstood. She doesn't have 20 years of sobriety. She's done 1 year 20 times. That always gets a little silent reaction around the room. And I was at 17 years, and it's almost like with very few exceptions, I had done a few of those years over and over and over, and nothing had changed. So when somebody suggested therapy to me, I said, yeah, because I've run out of tools. I've written 30 goddamn inventories. I've had more babies than I can count. I've gone to more institutions, more meetings. You know, just I've done it all in AA for years. I've worked the steps over and over and over, and I'm still in the same place. You know, I'm still doing the same goddamn things. I'm still picking the same kind of women. I'm still doing, you know, it's like I've achieved a lot of success. I've become a writer. And this is with zero, guys. So if you're sitting thinking you got to have education, forget it, you know. I mean, I have a 10th grade education. They threw me out of manual arts in the 10th grade. I have failed English ever since the 4th grade, and I am a phonetic speller, which is fun. I mean, a lot of people can't understand it, but I know what I mean. It's a bitch looking up words in a dictionary. If you can't hear the second letter, you have to start at the beginning with a ruler and work your way through. Until you find the one you want. And with all that, I managed to have a lot of success as a writer, so keep the faith. And yet, one of the ways I kept sabotaging myself, it's like I couldn't allow myself to accumulate any wealth out of what I was earning. And I was earning a lot of money, so the only way I could sabotage myself is pick women who like to spend money, right? So I would pick women who like to spend money, and they I picked well. They did outstanding. And if they'd even have a moment's twinge of consciousness and start to slow down, I'd encourage them to go on. Oh, that's okay. Buy another one, you know. So I would finish up every stint at a studio. I'd work at a studio for a year, and the show would be over, and I would be done, and I would be broke. Flat broke. Having made tens of thousands of dollars, I would be penniless. Not a dime.
And by now, they're gone, and I've got the bill from that, and I'm sitting one more time, you know, saying, Jesus, you know. Wonder what's wrong with them. So it was suggested to me that probably it wasn't them. I hated hearing that. Because I had gotten a lot of peace of mind out of thinking it was them. Probably one of the biggest awakenings in AA was in sobriety is when I finally found out I'm responsible for me. Damn, that was a heartbreaker. Because I kept thinking somebody else was going to come along and take that responsibility. That if I could just find her, she'd fix it. She'd be tall, blonde, and driving a Rolls Royce, and that would be it. I'd be okay then. She'd take me home, and the battle would be over. Everything would be all right. The rude awakening is... No, it's not a rude awakening. It's terrific. Anyhow, so I went. I went to a therapist. I said, okay. You know, my sponsor, who's 30 years sober, who is... I want to share this because I got angry the other day. A month or so ago, I heard a tape. I heard a tape of a guy 38 years sober who shall remain nameless from the Midwest. The most closed-minded Nazi I've ever heard in my life. How he's managed to stay sober is absolutely beyond me. I hope we share a podium at the same convention some year. From my mouth to your ears, God. This guy is so opposed to therapy, and he's convinced he's got the right way. Him and his little group are the only real way of working AA. There is nothing else but this way. And I'm like, I drive down to Laguna to see my sponsor, and I'm in a rage. You know, I'm like, how can they even put this shit on tape, man, and let people listen to it? He's going to kill somebody, for Christ's sake. You know, this fruitcake's 38 years sober. He's speaking with some kind of authority. This son of a bitch should be hung, tarred, and feathered. You know, I'm like, blah, you know. I said, he's still working the same program he was when he had a year of sobriety, from what it sounds like to me. Joe just smiles and says, possibly he missed... the part about where it says when all else fails, work with a new person. I said, oh, I got you. I understand. He missed the fact that it says in there it's okay to seek things. It's okay to try religion. It's okay to take your fist up with a priest if you want instead of an alcoholic if you choose. If you choose. I'm not suggesting it, recommending it. I know people who have done it. They're still here. I don't know what the hell to tell you. So if you need extra help, get the extra help. Don't let people put you in a box. The only thing that will keep you from it is fear. Okay? And when I went, I didn't care. 17 years, I didn't care. It was like, I just needed something. So I sit down with this lady, and she says to me, tell me a little bit about yourself. I figured if I was having problems with ladies, it was a good choice. Also, it would have just been some trip if I'd gotten into it with a guy. So she said, tell me a little about yourself. You know, start with your childhood. Tell me a little about yourself from the beginning. So I said, well, you know, when I was 15 years of age, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School. And I found the wonderful world of chemicals, drugs, and alcohol. Spent the next 11 years dealing narcotics, running them across the border, you know, running from the police, being drunk, sick, half crazy. Came to AA 17 years ago and been clean and sober ever since. She said, no, wait a minute. You missed my point. I said, start with your childhood. You weren't born at 15 years of age. I said, but I don't remember anything back past 15 years of age. It's a blank. She smiled. That look they get, you know, when they know they've got a winner. And I realized what had happened to me in AA was this, because I had taken countless inventories. But every one of them started at 15 years of age. But I was reading them to guys who couldn't remember back past 15 either. So they didn't think there was anything unusual about it. I'd say, well, at 15, and they just nod. Yeah, right. Yeah, I understand. My life started at 15, too, you know. So anyhow, she thought possibly we should go to work and find out what happened pre-15. Now, there was a time when I was so open-minded to this process that if a baby of mine went into it, I fired him. I just got rid of him. You know, I've always been open-minded to new things. Very flexible, spontaneous, responsive to change. Jesus. So I had babies going to therapy, and I'd say, that's it, I can't sponsor you. I mean, obviously, I'm not enough. What I'm dispensing isn't doing it for you, so screw you. Go find somebody else, you know. Giving them real love and support and encouragement as they try out something. It's amazing how we do that for each other around here. The thing that fries me, you know, just to give you an idea.
Whoa, stop. Where's it going?
One of the things, did I drive this far to do this? I mean, I may get tarred and feathered. One of the things that astounds me in Alcoholics Anonymous is my opinion you can get more support for failure here than you can success. You'll get more attention and more support if you fuck it up than you will if you do it right. You know, get a big new job earning a lot of money and share it at a meeting. Happy, too. I mean, be really excited about it, you know. Let me tell you what happened to me, man. I got this great goddamn job. The money's coming in basketfuls. I can't tell you how terrific it all is. And see how alone you are. When the meeting's over. But lose your ass. And there's 50 people there.
Everything? You really lost everything?
You want to go have coffee? The car, too? Let me buy you a car. You know, I mean, it's sad that we're that way, but we're that way for a reason. And the reason I treated people like that is because I wasn't in touch with my feelings. I walked around this program for 17 years not knowing what I felt. Listened to people talk about having their feelings hurt. Didn't know what they meant. Had no idea what you meant when you said to me, "You hurt my feelings." I just would stand there with this blank expression. I did not understand. So, what I'm convinced of now is that this process of finding out where we came from when we were this big is critical, my opinion, to any kind of really happy, functioning, fulfilling sober life. I don't know how without that information you can have it, because it's back there we got this yardstick of what we were worth. I grew up in a typical house, alcoholic father, neurotic mother, and in silence. Not a violent house. I grew up in the silent time that was lethal. Nobody did anything. My father got drunk and went to bed. That's it. I mean, that's the lie. He got up in the morning, he went to work, came home at night, ate dinner, went to bed, got drunk and went to bed. We didn't talk. We never said anything to each other. That was it. That was the sum total of my life as a child. Nobody held me. Nobody hugged me. Nobody encouraged me. My parents, if I'm asked to sum it up, I just simply say they were smart enough not to get a dog. Because they knew a dog would be too much responsibility, so they had a kid instead. I say that knowing what I'm talking about. It's like I grew up sleeping on the couch in the living room. I mean, my father had a good job, but they never cared enough to get a second bedroom. I slept on the couch. That was it. That was my identity went away underneath the couch in the morning with the sheets. There was no room. There was no posters. There's nothing hanging on the wall. There's no place for toys. There's nothing. So, needless to say, I grew up a little angry. And as the years went by, I blocked all of that out because all that was very painful. Well, now through this process of therapy, I have found out an interesting thing. I am wall-to-wall feelings. Wall-to-wall. The things I have run from all my life were the feelings. The things I was trying to stuff with all the drugs and all the alcohol was the feelings. It's what I'm afraid of. And the fascinating thing about that to me is the thing I'm the most afraid of is who I am. Because I am my feelings. I am nothing more than my feelings. I am not what I do for a living. I am not the car I drive. I'm not where I live. I'm not who I date. I am what I feel. That's it. That's the reality of it. This is me. The feelings going on. Oftentimes, they're inappropriate, guys, to the situation. I understand that. I know that when the car doesn't start, we consider calling suicide prevention instead of the auto club. I understand. I know oftentimes we'll overreact. The wife will move the ashtray from here to here, and you think about blowing her head off with a shotgun. That would be termed an inappropriate feeling, you know. One that should lead you to believe there's anger and hostility towards women that goes back before her. But we won't get into that. Anyhow, through this process, I have discovered four personalities. And I want to share them because they're my life today. The very first person I discovered I had never been in touch with, living inside of me, is a child. There's a little boy. He's about 2'3". He's got blonde curly hair, big blue eyes, little sailor suit, and he is adorable. I mean, he is an absolute jewel. He is the most beautiful little kid in the world. And he's happy. And he's curious, you know. And he's got a lot. He loves to look behind things, under things, through all of which he was never allowed to do when he was that size, man. It was, you know. Close that door. Don't stand there. You can't do that, you know. That's none of your business. But it's my... No. So now I try and let the child be curious. If he wants to go peek behind the door, it says employees open, I open it and pray the alarm doesn't go off, you know. Because there's also an adolescent who can't stand public humiliation or embarrassment. But the child, I've discovered, loves teddy bears. His very favorite thing in the whole world is teddy bears. So I have an apartment that is full of teddy bears. I have teddy bears in the living room. I have teddy bears in my office, my den. I have teddy bears in the bedroom. And when I travel, I take teddy bears with me. Because if I'm out of town somewhere, the bears are there, the kid is happy, I've already eliminated one whole set of possible problems. If the child is comfortable, if the child feels loved and safe, I can function. If he doesn't feel loved and safe, I will share a story about the child. I was working at Paramount Studios doing a show, and they were shooting Winds of War. There's a huge tank on the lot, and they were getting ready to shoot all the stuff with the ships, all the war stuff with the submarines and the ships, and they were using all miniatures, you know. All right, now, okay, guys, right? Get in touch with a little guy and imagine, you know, when he drives on the lot in the morning and sees 10-foot aircraft carriers and submarines that move and all of it wonderful and guns that fire. I mean, he was like, ugh. But I just said, hey, you know, we got things to do, and just walked right on by and went right on in my office. And I spent about 45 minutes in my office and accomplished nothing. Absolutely nothing. My mind kept wandering off. I'd turn the wrong page. I'd call the wrong person. I'd give my secretary the wrong instructions. And finally I said, okay, I give up. Walked back out, stood quietly, let the child watch part of what was going on with the filming it. Now, at this moment, the executive producer, my boss of the show, drives in, pulls up, sees me, saying, knows what my problems are, right? Knows I've got a show preparing, I haven't found a director to direct it, and a couple of other things, and we don't have a cast, but beyond that, it's a normal day. No big deal. He sees me standing there and says, oh, nice day. I said, yes, it is. Thank you. He says, you enjoying this? I said, well, actually, no. I said, I'd really rather be in my office working. I said, but my child in here see, now that I've come to love him, I got to defend him. You know, I can't ignore him anymore. He was ignored all of his life. So I said, my child in here, however, is very hung up on the activities here and has assured me if he doesn't get to watch some of it, I ain't going to get a fucking thing done all day long. At that point, Harv just drove on, wondering why he had given me the job, I'm sure, you know. Is he really running that show? Well, that explains that last cut. So the child is good. The child's easy. The child's requirements are simple. Simple. Basic. You know, it's like they say, was it Reich that said that the main problem of the human animal because is the child is begins with the child because we're the only animal that's capable of awe. The child can get so, and we run from the feeling. So we stuff it down. I mean, my whole life has been stuffing feelings. Now the child is a breeze. I mean, it's great. I have a lot of fun with the child. Now, the other personality, second personality, is the adolescent. Jesus. I mean, any of you that got teenagers you're trying to raise, you know, you understand the problem. I mean, having one living inside is incredible, you know, because he just doesn't understand a lot because his only yardstick, see, the only adults he ever saw were mom and dad. Based on their activity, he don't want to be one. He has decided he will stay an adolescent forever. Now, it seems to me that as I can tell, his only goal in life has been to find a girl with really large breasts and a cashmere sweater that he can cop a feel behind the locker door in the hallway and not get caught. Beyond that,
and look good doing it. Beyond that, he has no desires in life at all. He has no goals, wants no responsibility, and doesn't really care much about anything spiritual or anything else. He just wants to look good and chase pretty girls, right? Now, that's a problem, see? But discovering him set me free, all right? Because I used to do a lot of my running at the high school, at the high school in the morning. And some mornings I'd be running. Now, I'm a 48-year-old adult male, right? And these are children. And I'd be running, and I would be fine. I would be aware that I am a 48-year-old adult male, and that they're children. And other mornings I'd be running, and I would be crazed with this idea that they're all possible dates. Right? And I would think to myself, you're sick. You are really over the goddamn line, sucker. And who in AA are you going to talk to about this? Who in AA are you going to tell that you get fire comes out of your nostrils when you run the laps at the high school? Now that I know it's the adolescent, it doesn't rule my life anymore. I don't get crazed. I run in an area out by Santa Monica on San Vicente a lot when I'm running long runs. And during the summer, this last summer, from UCLA, as close as I can figure it, I think they unleashed the girls' volleyball team or somebody to run on San Vicente. Anyway, they all were about 18 or 19, all over 6 feet tall, and all absolutely gorgeous. I mean, absolutely goddamn magnificent, right? So I'm trucking down San Vicente one day, minding my own business, putting in my slow little miles, when coming the other way is this 6'2" brunette with about an 8-foot stride on her, running 6-minute miles and doesn't even know it, you know, just breezing along. And my adolescent gets one look at her and says, all right, it's her. Now, I've got all this energy rising as we pass, she and I'm trying to hold all this energy down, right? And she must have seen or sensed the struggle going on and gave this little smile as she went by. And my adolescent said, catch her! That's it, catch her! Now, if I thought that was me, you know, a 48-year-old adult, I would have felt really sick about the whole thing. I would have been ashamed, absolutely ashamed. But I knew who it was. So I said to him, I don't think we can catch her. He said, let's not be chicken shit at this point. Go for it. I said, you don't understand. If, on the off chance, we catch her, you are not going to be able to talk to her because we are going to have a serious breathing problem. His only adult, rational, mature response was, go for it. So I said, fine. Turned around. Did my best Alberto Salazar for about a half a mile, stretched my stride as far as I could stretch it. Half a mile later, I'm physically hanging on one of the banyan trees in the middle of San Vicente, ready to throw up, you know. I have stressed myself to the absolute aerobic maximum, right? And I'm hanging on this tree. And I'm saying to the adolescent, see? And he shut up. He was embarrassed. And I went on about my quiet little run. Now that I know who he is, see, but I also try and love him, because I got rid of a car 3 years ago, and I was looking at other cars, and the adolescent said, get a Corvette. I said, no, man, I don't want a Corvette. He said, get a Corvette, gotta get a Corvette. We gotta have a Corvette. I mean, he went nuts, you know. Every time one would go by, God, look how great that looks, you know. Oh, look at him. He said, there's a nice soft color. That's not loud. It's, you know, like beige. He really wanted red. So I said to him, well, what the hell? You know, nobody ever gave you a goddamn thing you didn't steal at gunpoint. So, you know, I got him the Corvette. Now, when I purchased this Corvette,
I had worked my way from the worst kind of insurance in the world to safe driver. I mean, super premium safe driver. It took me 10 years in AA just to get normal insurance, because I was one of those that believed vehicles were designed for fleeing the man. I didn't know they were for any other purpose, so I had drove them through yards, houses, and other things. So they weren't too anxious to insure me. So I get the Corvette, and I'm on safe driver insurance. Well, 2.5 years later, I was on assigned risk. And I kept trying to tell him, you don't understand, you see? You're screwing up your potential here with this car. And he said, oh, no, he promised me. I mean, we'd get on the freeway. He'd swear he was going to be better, you know? But he couldn't contain himself. Something about the height of the car and sitting low, and he just had to do it, you know? So when I'm standing out on Highway 5 with his highway patrol officer in his cowboy boots, and he's telling me how he's followed me between 95 and 110 for 8 miles, I'm saying to the adolescent, I don't think you're going to get to keep the car. And a few weeks later when I got the letter from the Department of Motor Vehicles saying one more ticket of any kind and you walk, I said to my adolescent, we're getting rid of the car. Now, what has transpired here, though? I just have a dull life, other than the sick voices. What's transpired here now is a very interesting situation with me. Just me and me. I mean, I gave him a shot. He asked for a Corvette. I bought it for him. I gave him an opportunity. He fucked it up. I took the car away. You know. We worked at it as good as we could. It was fair on all sides, you know. Now, after the adolescent's all right. I still have a little trouble with him occasionally. Well, I'll share one more thing, because this is important here. I trained a year to go run this marathon in Hawaii. I mean, it's something I really wanted to do, was run a marathon and finish it, because I've got one of these bodies that has been, you know, shot, stabbed, beaten, crushed vertebrae, the pelvis that was snapped in half. I mean, just destroyed. I'm not even supposed to be standing, much less running. So it just became a challenge, just something I really wanted to do. Now, I train for a year. I go to Hawaii 2 weeks early because I want to get used to the humidity. I don't want to, you know, pass out in heat. So I'm there a few days. I run the worst section of the marathon a couple of times. I take a couple of easy 13-mile runs. I'm feeling good. The weather's great. I've got it knocked. I just know inside. I'm just feeling like, hey, I got it wired. I got this 26 down. I run 22 miles before I left to go over there. I thought, it's all right. And I went to the gym to do a light workout. And I go to this gym. It's all knotless equipment. And I don't know anything about knotless equipment. I have free weights at home that I use. Now, the sensible thing to do, if you're in an environment with machinery you don't know anything about, is to ask someone how it works. I mean, that's not asking too much of the adolescent, is it? And there was a gym was filled with people, with staff embroidered on their shirt. Girls, boys, he could have asked anybody. But instead, as adolescents are wont to do, he just strides across the gym, looking good. Gets down on the bench to do the leg curls and wrenches a knee. So now I have to spend 10 days with ice and DMSO and doctors and trying to get the knee pieced together good enough to run the marathon. I got 18 miles and it went out. I finished. Friends said that I had the look of one who had to be shot to stop from finishing. But it wasn't exactly the marathon I had in mind. All because I couldn't ask a simple question. I had undone a year of really good effort on my part just because I couldn't risk not knowing about something. I couldn't say, God, I don't know anything about knotless equipment. I mean, I figured everybody in the world knew about knotless. Anyhow, enough of the adults. The third personality I've come to get acquainted with is the adult. The adult is very new to me. He and I have not been and had a relationship here long. The fascinating thing that I'm most intrigued by is that he's a very gentle soul. He's not at all like his past would lead you to believe he is. He is very sensitive, very gentle, very kind, very considerate of the feelings of others. And he's a beautiful man. He's really a beautiful man. I'm having a lot of fun getting to know him. The adolescent can't stand him because he's old. The kid adores him because he takes care of the kid. But it's nice to have that sense of... See, my biggest fear when I began this process of trying to tear the crap away, trying to get out of that hamster wheel, was that if I ever got really gentle, if I ever got really kind and really soft and really cared, people would fuck over me. I believe that to the very depths of my soul. And the fascinating thing is, the gentler I become today, the kinder I become, the less I let people take advantage of me. I am harder to screw around with today than I was when I thought I had it together. Because I just don't let people do it to me anymore. Because I know what I feel. If I don't feel like doing something, I just say, geez, I'd love to, but I just don't feel like it. I'm sorry. And let them deal with the reaction. You know, it's because I can now speak for me. And I never could. I was always geared by other people and what they thought, looking good, having all that feeling. Now, the fourth personality is really not a personality as much as it is a voice. It is that negative voice. It is that voice that's been with me ever since I can remember. It talks me out of everything. Anytime I want to take on a new project, start a new idea, make any change in my life, do anything spontaneous, this voice is there to tell me I ain't going to make it. I'm going to fail. I'm worthless. It's never going to work. Disaster is just around the corner. The bump on my knee is bone cancer. I wake up in the morning. Mine likes to get me in the morning. First, upon awakening is when it's there to talk. It's almost as if it says good morning. You know, it's like, oh, I'm glad you're up. I've waited to speak to you. I want to tell you that you didn't get enough sleep. You're very tired, which is going to make this an extremely stressful day. You probably won't get near the things done that you have to get done today. There's no way in hell you can, so you better eliminate something now because it's all beyond anything you can do. And on top of that, nobody's going to fucking... And, you know, soon I'm laying there, you know, I'm in a sweat, right? I haven't even got out of bed. And I wonder why alcoholics don't leap out and join the day, you know. When it's your last one, why should you, you know? It's awfully hard to move forward in life when you've got that going on. That's the one voice I have to fight. But today it's pretty easy because the child hates the voice. The adolescent can't hear it. And the adult just quietly says, that's not the truth. That's not the truth. And now that I have someone to point out to my mind what is the truth, the mind has lost its power. It still talks, it still says all the same things, but it's lost its power. I can't remember who it is who gives, one of the best examples of it I know is a guy that was saying that he wanted to be a lawyer. He's talking to his sponsor about being a lawyer. And he said, you know, but Jesus, when I graduate from law school, I'll be 44 years old. And his sponsor said, how old will you be then if you don't graduate? But that, to me, is the best example of the subtleness of this sucker as it tries to maneuver you out of any kind of progress. You know, because in order to progress, you've got to take chances. Life, by its very nature, is spontaneous. And I want control. You know. I mean, I'd really like to be spontaneous, you understand, but there's just a few things I want to get straight first. My whole life was control. Everything in the right place. I don't want to let anybody do anything their way. It makes me uncomfortable if you eat your cereal different than me, you know. I want you to use the same bowl, same amount, slice the banana the same way. Otherwise, there's something wrong with you, you know. My need for control is just overwhelming, you know. It's great not to have to do all that today. So, what is life like 21 years sober with four people? It's terrific. My life today is outstanding. I have a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun when I'm around the house. When I'm around my house now, there's life there. It used to be the only way you would have ever known there was anybody living where I lived was you might hear a door open and close. Possibly the refrigerator door would open and close. A light might go on and off. And then occasionally a toilet would flush. But other than that, there was no sign of life where I lived. And when I was home alone, I was alone. And the reason I was so horribly lonely is because I wasn't in touch with my feelings. And by running from my feelings, nobody was there. Nobody was home. Now that I've got this volcano of feelings, there's always something going on in my house. It's never quiet. I'll wake up somewhere, I'll be walking across the living room, and I will be overwhelmed by sadness from back when. I won't even know from when. And I'll sit quietly on a couch in a little ball, and I'll cry like a child. The sadness has got to come out. The thing I've learned is this stuff's got to come up because it's between me and life, right? And my mind goes crazy. You can't. What's wrong with you? What kind of fucking program do you work curled up crying? Jesus Christ, you know. Don't you understand? Peace of mind is feeling nothing. What is this sadness shit? You're okay. Just don't be crying. Give it up, you know. Stop that. Knock it off, you know. And that's all my whole life has been, stop being me. So I'm sad. So I'm crying. So who the hell cares? Big deal. You know, what does it matter? Or I'll be happy around my... All my plants are alive today. I mean, that's an out-and-out miracle, man. To give me a plant prior to 2 years ago was guaranteed death sentence. You know, if you had something you didn't want, even cactus was guaranteed to die. It would die because... A, there was no life, me, in the house, and it never got any care because it needed things. And if I see, somebody said something to me years ago, and I hated it so bad, I blocked it until I heard it again in a new place of mine. And because I didn't want to hear, somebody said to me, look, a good relationship requires love, compassion, understanding, and intimacy. And until you can give love, compassion, understanding, and intimacy to yourself, it will be impossible for you to give it to another person. I didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to hear that. That's the old two halves don't make a whole. If you're under a year, ignore that. Two halves make a whole. Anything keeps you hanging in is fine. Don't get emotionally involved is not written in the literature. Someone came up with that. Probably the same guy that picked up the think stuff. I'd like to talk about my plants, but that's ridiculous. No, I'll give you some insight into me, and I still have to grow. I got one plant. It did so well. It grew so tall. It grew beyond its stick, and it needed a bigger pot, right? I mean, it just got up and started a hangover. I found myself sitting on the couch looking at this plant, right? Wonder why I've had some bad relationships? Listen to this. I looked at this plant that's going over like that, and I'm saying to the plant, what the fuck do you want from me now? Yeah. God damn it, I've given you water, care, sunlight, fertilizer. Now you need a bigger pot, another goddamn stick. You know. Is there no end to this, for Christ's sakes? It has its stick and its new pot. It's doing fine. If, I guess what I'm trying to say to you is, if you're stuck, don't be afraid to find new tools to use to keep moving. Because I'm now 21 years, and I'm excited. I mean, I'm just getting going, you know. Life hasn't come to an end. It isn't over, you know, 21 years sober, I ain't dead, you know. I'm so excited about the potential from here that I can't stand it. You know, I want to know what's coming. It's like, what's next? God, great. Where do I go from here? Where is the adult going to go? The child, the adolescent? How are they going to change? What growth is going to go on? You know, I mean, it's like, I'm stoked about life. You know, and most guys have given it the fuck up at this age. You know, 48, 21 years sober. I love getting off planes when I go to other towns to talk. You know, because I watch the guy, whoever it is to meet me, goes up to everybody with gray hair on canes. You know, they can find because 21 years sober, that guy should be over the goddamn hill, you know. Finally, I'll walk up and say, I think you're looking for me. Oh, no, I'm looking for, you know. Life is just starting. Be good to yourself. That's the one thing we don't seem to know how to do around here, is be good to ourselves. Quitting smoking is a great way to be good to yourself. You may not want to hear it. It may really make you angry. But just remember, it's a little tiny gun with a little tiny bullet. And why? Why? Because all it's doing is stuff in the feelings. I don't know what you use cigarettes for, but I can remember. I don't want to give it. Oh, well, what the hell? One of the things I've discovered is that the most intimate moments of possible between a man and a woman. Is this really my hey talk? The most intimate moments between a man and a woman are those moments that they share after they have made love. It is after. It's not the before. It's not the during. It's that moment after when the armor's down, when you're really vulnerable. That is the true intimacy. All my life, man, I mean, I had a routine, right? The moment after you turn over, turning your back on the poor person, you've already closed them off, take the cigarettes off the nightstand, light one, get a deep drag, now you roll back over. You ever try to talk to nicotine about intimacy? It doesn't understand. I'm delighted to be. I would like to, and don't ever let it, you know, the other thing is, when you're in meetings and you're sharing your feelings, don't ever let anybody stop you from sharing feelings. We don't talk a lot about feelings around here. They talk so much more about feelings at adult children than they do in AA. It's criminal. It's criminal. That we don't talk about, you know, don't let people express. It's like in AA, so you get a lot of shit if you express feelings around here. I've heard people, I went to a podium one time, I got up and I said, I just watched an afternoon school special on TV, and it was about a little boy and his best friend. And I got to this meeting and I was a speaker and I got up to talk, and I was really moved by this show about this little boy and his best friend because I never had a best friend. I never, ever in my life as a child had a best friend. I was already so alone, so isolated, so quiet, and so angry, I couldn't let anybody else into my space. So I never had a best friend. So I get up at the podium at this meeting to speak, and I said, God, I watched this thing, you know, and I discovered I never had a best friend. And half the room goes, oh, well, I went crazy. We won't go into what I said. But, I mean, they're trying to get me to do the very same thing I've done all my life, which is apologize for my feelings. I was feeling very sad that I never had a best friend. I was really hurt by that. I should feel sad. That is sad. That's a very sad thing. If you had a rotten childhood, that's a very sad thing. I'll finish with one thing. Because something came. See, the thing I've had to discover around here is somebody said to me early on in my sobriety, forgive your mother and dad, they did the best job they could. I said, okay, great, you're forgiven. And then I went on with destructive relationships, unable to relate to people, and generally put 17 years of my life in the toilet, you know. But I forgave them. It was okay. Now what I've discovered is the person that was talking to me was right. Right. Absolutely correct. They did the best job they could. They couldn't have done it any better. But, you see, there's another part to that issue. They did a rotten fucking job. A really rotten job. And if I think the job they did was okay, then I think I'm wrong. I think there's something bad about me. It's taken me forever to forgive my mother what went on as I was a child. And I finally forgave her this last Christmas. Over Christmas, I stayed home and spent Christmas by myself. Cooked a turkey for me. It's what I wanted to do. The bird didn't come out well, but that's beside the point. It was something I wanted to do for me, is just cook a Christmas meal for me. And through this process, I reached a point where I sat down, I got very quiet, and I thought, God, I forgive her. I remembered that she was a small child once and had hopes and dreams and desires just like me, and her family crapped on hers just like mine crapped on mine, and that she'd done the very best job she could. And I forgave her. But I also came to another conclusion. I also don't like her. She's not a nice person. I mean, I'd like to say she is, but she's not. And I don't have to apologize anymore. I don't have to bullshit anymore. That's just reality. And I don't have to. I'd rather feel guilty than resentful. I don't have to drive down there anymore for holidays and die. But it's like getting in touch with that stuff can set you free. And the best example of that, a couple of years ago, this gal had her first birthday, and her mother, who was 4 years sober, called her on the phone. And she said, look, she said, about all I can give you for your birthday is this. I want you to know that I am aware that I am responsible for most of the problems you have in your life today. She said, but please, for your sake, understand you are responsible for the solutions to those problems. And that's the reality of it, you know. And it's, if you can just cut yourself free from that, because my experience has been I've had to relive all that pain and set myself free from it so I can go forward today. It may not be your experience, but then I was asked to share my experience tonight, and you can share yours next week, and God bless you, and thank you very much.